Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Dish with Dina podcast. I am so happy to have you join us. Today, my guest is Drusilla Rosales. Drew and I dish about all things nutrition because, like me, Drew is a registered dietitian. But this week, we are focusing on National Eating Disorders Awareness. So just a trigger warning that some of the language we use within our conversation in this episode might be a little bit uncomfortable for anyone who is sensitive to this topic. Drew has over 13 years working with families, children, and adolescents in a variety of settings, and our conversation spans everything from boundaries and permission to gastrointestinal issues to letting go of guilt and approaching our patient and client population with neutrality. So sit back, enjoy the conversation, and let's dish. Welcome, Drew Rosales, to the Dish with Dina podcast. Thanks so much for spending time with me today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you asking me to be on.
Since we do not have a history together prior to this, I would love to learn a little bit more about not just your area of expertise, but really how did you even get involved in becoming a registered dietitian? Because that's what you and I have in common with our credential.
I think it's interesting. Most of us, I think as dietitians, we get into the field, maybe not. We don't all set out being like, you know what, I'm going to study nutrition. There's usually, you know, some things in life. And I think I always had an interest in sports and thought I would go into like athletic training. I did kinesiology as an undergrad and did some athletic training work. And I was like, you know, I don't know that I want to tape ankles for the rest of my life. And so I had some professors early on who tried to urge me to go to medical school. And I was like, I don't really want to do that. And so kind of roundabout came to nutrition and like, well, maybe I'll work with athletes and, you know, and just ended up kind of finding my way into working with adolescents with eating disorders. And so, and I've done lots of different things, as a dietitian, I've done a lot of work in research and things, but it always kind of comes back to, eating disorders and weight management and kind of that whole weight spectrum. And I just really found that I loved adolescents. They're a tough population, but I really love the fact that they're so moldable and, you know, they're at an age where they're kind of wanting independence from parents. And so they really start to look up to maybe some other adults. And I really felt that, you know, I could be an influential person and really try to make a difference. So it just kind of like somewhat organically happened. And then, like I said, I've, you know, in lots of different avenues, I just always come back to focusing in on this population and you know, probably for the past 14 years have worked on and off with eating disorders. So I love it. It's tough, but I love it.
It can be quite challenging. I've mentioned on previous episodes to clarify some of the language that we're going to be using. So being a dietitian, a registered dietitian is a protected title, and we have to abide by certain scopes of practice. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a sec, Drew. And then in the population of pediatrics, that can span anywhere between 0 to 20 years of age. And so in your case, you really are working with children of the age that, like you said, are becoming a little bit more self-reliant, self-resourceful. They're also a little bit more independent or growing in that way. They're not maybe entirely 100% responsible for purchasing their food, but they might have a good experience in the kitchen or at home in playing a role in creating meals for themselves or being, you know, helping out in some way. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. But I want to go back for a sec, just as far as your internship, because a lot of people who are listening to this, they are within the health and wellness world. And I also have a lot of nutrition students, dietetic interns, and also newly credentialed dietitians. And we all have very different ways that we have experienced our either academic journey, our internship, or where we're currently landing. So did you get any concentration or focus on the pediatric population in a certain way, shape, or form when you were doing your internship, if you go back to that moment in time?
Yeah. So I would say, I mean, our program did a really good job of, I did a, coordinated program, right? So, you know, it was kind of limited to what the school had set up. They did a really good job of kind of trying to diversify our experiences. I wouldn't say I specifically had a pediatric, you know, rotation or anything. Unfortunately, I kind of sought out this experience. I found a job. And so I was working while I was going to RD school, I was working part-time at a residential eating disorder facility. And so I would, you know, just work there nights and weekends. And happen to get experience that way. But I do know, you know, I've actually worked in other programs, and there are specialized rotations. So they are out there, you know, and that's something for prospective students to look into. You know, the programs you're looking into, where do they do rotations? You know, do they have anybody who specializes in that? Because there are so many more programs now that do take interns through the internship rotations, or sometimes if you're interested in that, you just have to reach out and, you know, start emailing some people. And, you know, I would get emails all the time from interns like, hey, you know, can you take me for a rotation? I've jumped on calls just to give advice and, you know, things like that. So I think it's probably twofold, you know, depending on the program. Lots of programs now are incorporating some rotations, but I think specifically in the eating disorder field, I think that's something I hear a lot is, how do we get experience? You need experience, but how do we get it? And so sometimes you got to be a little creative and kind of promote yourself and get out there.
Yeah. And I think, like you mentioned, with the twofoldedness of this too, also coming from the side of the patient or the client, of recognizing that certain people might have a little bit more training, schooling, credentialing in a specialty. And whether that's an eating disorder specialty or it's renal disease or diabetes, a lot of what we do as dietitians is part of your interdisciplinary healthcare team, and we have a general knowledge of almost everything. But then once we start fine tuning into something, like I know for myself, I have some training in diabetes. I work with a lot of patients in that realm. But if I do notice something that is a little bit tricky for me, I don't feel super comfortable, then I'm very much going to reach out to my giant group of networking dietitians within my network, I should say, and find somebody who does specialize a little bit in that, kind of like niching into that market, because you are all the ones that are keeping up with the current research and or hot topic discussions. And in the case of eating disorders, what I want to have a conversation with you about, Drew, is that it's much different than just any other clinical condition, because it does tie into mental health conditions or mental health diagnoses. And so a lot of times what we'll see with true diagnosed patients with an eating disorder is they're going to have a referral or have some kind of relation with a psychotherapist, a behavioral therapist, and that's not necessarily in our scope. So I want to, you know, always be careful of our language, of if I'm triggering somebody with what I'm stating. A lot of the students that come out of schooling and even in their internship, whatever experience they get, they might not be super savvy with the language and how to address that, or even how to recognize if an eating disorder has happened, if it hasn't been formally introduced as a diagnosis or a referral. So within the time that we have in this podcast, can you share a little bit about the nuances involved? And maybe even if this has come up in your world as well, talk a little bit about that clinical supervision that not a lot of us get in certain areas of, you know, medical discussions, but that is a little bit more necessary in the world of eating disorders.
Yeah. So kind of touching back to that mental health point, absolutely. I think, you know, it's super important to recognize that, you know, depending on the setting that you're working in, right? It could be, you know, there are lots of residential inpatient, outpatient facilities, there's hospitals, there's, you know, you could be an RD in private practice. So there's lots of different settings you can work with eating disorders. I feel very, very fortunate that most of my work has been with a team, right? Like a team of either therapists and physicians. So it's been very easy to collaborate and, you know, kind of have those case meetings where we get together and discuss patients and make sure we're all on the same page. And that, I'll say, is the most ideal situation. If you have everybody on the team right there that you're working closely with, I think you're going to also have better outcomes for your patient, right? Your whole team's on the same page, you know, no one's, and you know, eating disorder, you know, some of those patients can be a little manipulative. And I don't say that in a bad way, right? It's that it's part of the disease. It's part of the mental health process. And so when you're working as a team, there's, you're stronger together. And I think you're able to hold those boundaries for your patient better. So that's ideal, right? And I think in that situation, it's a lot easier to know, you know, okay, hey, why don't you talk with your therapist about that? I know you have an appointment tomorrow. That's perfect. I'm going to chat with her and we'll make sure you guys discuss that. And it's easy to kind of know where those boundaries are. And they do blur a little bit. I think as you get more experienced, you kind of know, and as you work with your team, you know what they're comfortable with and things like that. You know, working in a pediatric hospital for so long with a team, you know, I feel like our MDs were very comfortable coming to me and saying, hey, I know you just met with this patient. What do you think? Should we admit them or not? And so they were, you know, we had that type of relationship where they knew what I was looking at, and we were able to give those types of recommendations. But when you're in a setting like private practice, for example, or maybe you're a student and you're seeing a patient and you're very concerned, that's when I think it's much trickier, and you have to be a lot more careful and, you know, make sure you're checking in, you know, does this patient have a physician? Do they have a therapist? Because a lot of the times they don't. You might be the first person that they have said something to or that has picked up on it because you've done a dietary recall. And so I think in those cases, it's really important to, if they don't have those team members involved, get those team members involved. And, you know, most dietitians I know who work in private practice have very strict policies about not working with a patient if they don't have those other members of the treatment team, because it is a liability and it can be a very scary situation if they're very sick.
Absolutely detrimental. And so herein lies kind of the concern about, well, how do I get experience if I don't have experience? And in the case of the eating disordered world, then you would be having probably somebody partner up or shadow with you, or you would sit in perhaps and observe something, or like you said, to review case loads and get some feedback on that so that you are using the proper language or being mindful of that. And in the patient or client's role, that if they don't have somebody else in their interdisciplinary team, they really should not be relying solely on the dietitian, because as I tend to say too, like when you're working with a generalist of a, you know, primary care physician, and they're talking to you about very general things, but they know that you have a diagnosis of something like diabetes or hypertension, they could very well just hand you a piece of paper and off you go, or tell you what to eat and what not to eat, but they're not trained specifically in food and nutrition. So it really behooves the patient or even the healthcare provider to refer out to a dietitian. Same case with the dietitian in the role when you're working with somebody who, even if it's not an official diagnosis of an eating disorder, but you're noticing certain patterns that seem more behavioral based, that you really try to say, let me get someone in on this, and I can't be your therapist in this case.
Exactly.
It's outside my scope. So for the people listening to this right now, can we go through some of the definitions of your, you know, usual typical eating disorders, and then maybe some of the more nuanced things that are starting to come up as well that we're recognizing as potential disordered eating behaviors?
Yeah. So I think that the common ones that people tend to hear or feel like they might know about are, you know, anorexia nervosa. That's your typical, I feel like the most well-known, right? We tend to see dramatic weight loss, you know, really where kids are not eating very much. So it tends to be more noticeable because physically there can be some very drastic changes. With that, we'll kind of, however, I feel like recently we see a lot more of the atypical, what we call atypical anorexia nervosa. And you know, you may not know. There may be weight loss, there may not, or a person could be have already been in a larger body size and lost a dramatic amount of weight, but they're still quote unquote healthy and normal on the BMI charts, which we all know we have to look at very, very carefully and pay attention to trends. So I feel like that's something that I've seen increase in the past several years, you know, from I'd say from when I first started working in the field until the past few years, especially with the COVID pandemic. I think we saw a bigger increase in that. And so, you know, I feel like that one gets missed a lot, or either missed completely, or I'd say the treatment recommended doesn't tend to be as intense because people just think, oh, wow, well, you know, this person was overweight, they might have been classified as obese, and so we're happy they lost weight. And, you know, some of us that are more trained, we look at those growth charts and we're like, no, this is not a good thing. This is very dangerous. Their heart rate is low. And so, I think that's the category that, you know, I think bringing to people's attention that just because somebody has lived in a larger body size and they lose a lot of weight, that doesn't always mean that's a good thing. And that doesn't always mean that it can't be an eating disorder or it can't be anorexia nervosa. I think it's very confusing for people to hear that diagnosis because they're like, well, I'm not underweight, you know, I'm fine. And it's like, no, you've lost a lot of weight in a short period of time. You are technically malnourished. So that's a tricky one. And then bulimia nervosa is kind of the other typical one we hear about, right? You know, there's all sorts of compensation that happens to get rid of the food. So it might not be that one is avoiding food and limiting food intake, but they're doing negative things to compensate for what they're eating. And that could look like, it doesn't always have to be, you know, self-induced vomiting. It could be over-exercise. You know, it could be abusing laxatives or things like that, you know, so there's lots of other methods that they might do. And I think, again, that can be tricky for people to notice, or it's easier to hide if you know, one's not really looking for it. And again, same, you know, there may not be weight loss. There may be weight gain, right? Because we know those methods are not always effective for losing weight, but again, can be very dangerous, right? Very easy to have electrolytes off, to be dehydrated. So just as serious, you know, and then I think that, you know, I feel like some of the trendier terms we hear too, like orthorexia, kind of more of an obsession with healthy eating. And I feel like that's something too, that's, we see a lot of, or even with, I mean, I say more with men and boys, but it could also happen in girls too, but that tendency to want to just gain muscle, and be bigger, you know, so lots of different ways you can look at it and, you know, may or may not be official in the DSM-5, but things that we recognize clinically, right, that we would try to observe and screen for in our population of adolescents.
And that goes somewhat in line with, you know, were these concerns as the patient, where they first start feeling the effects of what they need to do to enter into this eating disorder realm, whether it has to do with body image or whether it's positive or negative influences, whether it's trauma or abuse. I mean, there's so many factors that are involved. And then the case of something like you mentioned too with orthorexia, you know, I'm thinking of kind of like the ideal, quote unquote, perfect approach to health, your optimal health. And this is where it's a great conversation. We might not have time to talk about this too much here in our discussion, Drew, but like more outwardly of being mindful of the language we use when we say things like I eat clean.
Oh.
Right, these like marketing terms that come up, or I'm going on my detox. You know, if I had a dollar for everything, I'd be sitting on a giant pile of dollars. And oh, yeah. So this is also the reason why I love having conversations like this, because we really come from the credentialed, experienced professional side of things to explain what people are hearing. And especially in the world, which is how I'm going to kind of segue this now, especially in the world of social media, it's so prevalent being online and on the internet, and especially in the population of the adolescent who is starting to get influenced, is starting to develop physically in different ways that they might start comparing themselves. You know, 12-year-old children are watching, like, you know, makeup tutorials on YouTube, or they might find somebody that they feel is like an ideal role model to them and start venturing in the what I eat in a day discussions. Or again, it could also come from, you know, more grassroots things of what they're experiencing at home, but they could be escaping into the world of social media and getting affected. And so again, the language that you use of malnutrition can span a spectrum. It can be undernourishing yourself. It could be excessive consumption of something, but really the true issues behind that all, aside from calories, aside from caloric intake, is what Drew mentioned of metabolically what's going on underneath it all, nutritionally what's going underneath it all. Are you deficient in something? Is there something throwing off your healthy lab values? And that, as you said, doesn't have to be just by looking at someone's body and saying, oh, that person must have an eating disorder. We can't make that distinction. And it's much more nuanced than that. So share with us a little bit too about what you see as far as maybe unfortunate trends and statistics that are going on in the adolescence world. And again, stating, you know, mostly girls we see, but it can definitely affect boys as well.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like the population of, you know, young boys has increased. Like I mentioned, the population of kids that are actually living, you know, of higher weights, definitely increasing there. And, you know, our population of gender identity, you know, our kiddos that are struggling with their gender identity and things like that, we definitely see an increase in eating disorders in that population. So it's definitely not just, you know, that stereotypical young Caucasian girls. Like, it is really any ethnicity, you know, any gender, it affects anyone. And so, you know, you mentioned social media and language, and that's huge. You know, we're definitely part of what I do, right, is kind of training families on how to change that language. And when I hear it in real life, I mean, like day to day, right, I cringe. And it's one of those things that, like, we're so careful in our own home too about the language we use, because that clean, or even the words healthy and unhealthy, like, I have banned those. I'm like, we can't even use those anymore. Like, all foods are good for us. It's just a matter of how much are we having them and when. But yeah, there's so many influences that I feel like you know, it's really hard to say, oh, there's this specific population that eating disorders are affecting, because it's really quite rampant. And unfortunately, the pandemic did not assist us in, you know, eating disorders and mental health in general.
Right. Whether we look to food as a comfort or restrict it as a form of control, and then state of, you know, isolation or feeling a little bit displaced, obviously that's all going to take a role. And, you know, if we talk about too, on a more general way of disordered eating patterns, again, for people who are watching this, you can see me, I'm putting this around quotations because that is a label representative of anything that might not be clinically defined as, or in the mental health diagnosis as something, then it could be something that is just affecting how our patterns are, of whether it's often or it happens when there's like a trigger that happens and this is your reaction to it. So you don't necessarily have to have a formal eating disorder diagnosis to experience some form of disordered behaviors. And so can you talk a little bit too, as the professional, what are some signs that you're looking out for? Because it could be, you know, especially for newbies who are just coming into this field, or even as a healthcare professional in general, who might be all about numbers and insurance reimbursement and doesn't have a lot of time to get to know the patient in front of them. What are some things that we're looking out for? Could it be language? Could is there anything maybe in appearance that we should be watching for too? That's just to say, hey, I'm concerned about something and here's how I would like to address it.
Yeah, I think you mentioned, you know, the patterns are key. Kind of if you're starting to notice, whether it's, you know, with a family member or a patient you're working with, you know, patterns in meal skipping or avoiding certain foods or food groups, right? All of a sudden somebody, I hate saying like vegetarianism, right? Like not all, this is a type of independence. Some kids choose to be vegetarian because of lots of different reasons, right? Religion, family, you know, they love animals, but you know, it is a red flag. You know, what are the reasons, and are they having a helpful vegetarian diet, right? Is it well-rounded, or are they using this as a way to manipulate foods and cut out food groups? So I think food-wise, those are the things to kind of, you know, do you have a preteen and, you know, you notice that they're like skipping dinner because they have homework, or, you know, just little things like that. Like, are we too busy to grab breakfast in the morning when they used to always eat breakfast? Are they not buying lunch at school? Are they not packing lunch? You know, just kind of picking up on those things that I think sometimes we just, the go unnoticed, we take for granted, oh, kids skip meals. Well, they shouldn't. And so I think trying to keep track of behaviors like those, or are they always going to the bathroom after a meal? You know, do they disappear for long times? Have you noticed, you know, increases in exercise? Some of those types of things. And physically, you know, there are things, you know, like hair, I think is telling. I mean, that might take a little bit longer, but is hair all of a sudden kind of looking like brittle, not so shiny? You know, the face, are we getting dry? Or, you know, do we kind of see chapped lips a lot? You know, obviously if somebody is vomiting, right, you can sometimes look at hands and see, or you can kind of sometimes look at the face. Are the cheeks puffy? Those, it takes a little bit more training to kind of pick up on that. But there are things you might see, or are they just like more tired than usual? Are they weak? Are they, and it's, I think it's hard with adolescents in particular, because parents are like, well, they're always grumpy. And I'm like, well, there's a difference between that normal teenage grumpy and just, you know, are they like hungry grumpy, right? So kind of trying to pick up on those like subtle changes in behavior and trying to separate them out from like, is this just normal teenage behavior, or is this a pattern that I'm seeing that is unhealthy, or there are a couple of patterns and we're going to put those together and realize, you know, maybe we should get this checked out because this just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, there's so many things. Like, you don't want to constantly be at somebody and question things that could also set them off in some way to go deeper into whatever their diagnosis or behavioral patterns are. But then there's also a concern of recognizing patterns of, you know, I didn't say anything, but now that it's been a couple of weeks, I'm noticing this is something new that I'm seeing from you. And as the healthcare professional too, just as a side note, I always take copious notes. So as you're seeing my head go down, my listeners know I'm sitting here scribbling things. But as a healthcare professional, you know, one of the things I had started writing was nutrition focused physical exams. Like, that's how we start seeing maybe some gauntness or some fat pockets disappear or appear. You mentioned the changes in hair and brittleness of something, but also if it's gotten to the extreme factor, especially I think in younger children, but even older people too. And I think especially in anorexia nervosa, where you might start seeing peach fuzz, like hair showing up on the arms because your body's thinking it's being starved. And it is in some cases, it's restricting and it's losing fat and muscle. So it's trying to help you gain heat and protect you in that way. So little things like that might start showing up that we can be aware of. You mentioned two vegan approaches, which, like you said, yes, everybody's got a reason to do something. If they want to change up their eating patterns, that's totally fine. But people who run healthy vegan diets, or, you know, nutritionally dense and energy dense vegan diets, are doing fine. There's not a ton of restriction on there. They're meeting their caloric needs. They're meeting their nutritional needs or micronutritional needs. And I also think too, if I can throw in there, gastrointestinal discomforts or people with GI diagnoses, who that condition might actually exacerbate an eating disorder because they become so fearful of the result or a symptom that appears when I eat this, this is how I feel. And especially in cases that are a little bit harder or trickier to manage, like IBS or, you know, something in the lower gut where maybe it's just you ate fibrous food and you're bloating now, or that's just how your body processes things and you're going to the bathroom. But if it becomes severe cramping and it becomes something that they can't socialize anymore, and you go out to eat and it's like, what's in this? I can't eat that. The language that comes up of questioning, like, why were you given a specific meal or diet to adhere to lessen that, but are you still getting what you need as far as calories and nutrition is concerned? Because there's a way for us as dietitians to help you with that. We can cobble together something that meets all your needs, so you're not feeling deprived, whether you are playing a role in that or you just feel like you don't have anything to choose from. Would you like to share anything about that too, with food preferences, as well as we age, we come through different changes of stages of life and what we're going through, if you wanted to elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, definitely GI. We didn't even touch on that. That's how a lot of patients would get referred from GI, right? Because they're like, oh, what's going on? And that it does become tricky when there are physical symptoms, because, you know, they are very real physical symptoms, but we're trying to manage that. And it does get challenging. I can say from personal experience, my youngest was actually just diagnosed with celiac disease like 2 months ago. So personally, you know, I'm currently dealing with that and the language that we use, right? Because she's only 7 and she's already like, why does my body hate me? Like, why does this and all this, you know, she's kind of was starting to avoid foods and speak negatively, and just reframing that language, right? And just saying, no, like, this is not about your body. Your body is still amazing. It still does amazing things. We just have a reaction to this food. And so we're going to find a way to, you know, choose foods that don't make your belly hurt, right? And so it is really come down to like the language and reframing things to where, like, yes, I understand that you get a very physical reaction when you have these foods. But that doesn't mean we need to avoid all things. Like, we can, you know, we're just going to replace that with this and these other foods that are still going to meet those nutrients. And so I think some of it has to do with language and just making sure that we're not focusing on all the things they have to avoid, right? Whatever the allergy or whatever, you know, the intolerance or diagnosis is, it's just focusing on, okay, what can we do? Because I think sometimes we get so caught up in like what we can't have. And then it becomes like this, like, yes, like, I can't eat anywhere. I have to avoid this. And it's like, no, let's flip that. Where can we eat? What can you do? What are the things that you can do to make this, you know, doable? And so, you know, and with or without an eating disorder, right? These things can stem from an eating disorder. It can lead to disordered eating. But I think it's important that we kind of, at any area that we're practicing, and we watch the language that we're using, especially with kids. And then as an adult, right, you mentioned, as you get older, just working with families and seeing sometimes like the parents being like, well, you know, we don't need carbs, so we just don't need them. And I'm like, well, you may not need as many carbs as you age because your metabolism is declining, but your children do. And so it's just kind of trying to set that that groundwork that, like, yes, your needs may be changing and the way you eat may be changing, but we have to be mindful of what our kids need and what we say around them and how we present that. And, you know, and so it's definitely like, we have those conversations around our dinner table at home. Like, you know, like, yeah, mommy and daddy, our bodies aren't growing anymore. Yours are growing. So you guys need more than we do, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But it's just watching the language we use and making sure that I try not to do too much nutrition education around the table, right? We don't want to like focus on that too much, but at the same time, just subtly kind of throwing that in so kids understand why you might be doing something different than they're doing. Because your kids are watching and they're picking up on that. And if, you know, mom's not eating carbs, then they're not going to eat carbs, right? So I think it's just kind of being mindful all the way around, no matter whether or not you're dealing with a diagnosed eating disorder or anything. It's watching that language to make sure that we're really being sensitive to the fact that these kids are hearing this, or people around are hearing it, and you just never know what's going on. And we just want to be mindful that that language is not going to set something off, like you mentioned, you know?
Yeah. And I think this is a great entrance into my next question, which is about the family dynamics, whether you have a traditional mom, dad, and two kids, or abuela is taking care of the children when the parents might be out of the house, or however your family looks like, right? The people that you're spending most of the time eating, or people who are shopping and preparing meals for you. You know, I have switched my language as a dietitian recently, where I'm starting to just use the word neutrality a lot more. I'm not placing an emphasis on, right, good or bad foods. There's no guilt or morality built into the choices that we make. I try to make sure people have some flexibility and freedom, but I also recognize there are a lot of people out there that do not have equity or access to nutritionally dense, affordable foods that are accessible to them in the location wise, or the ability to purchase those things. So, you know, maybe they do have to make choices that are a little bit different than, I guess, in the hierarchy of foods, you know, from whole foods to ultra processed foods. There's a happy medium in there. And that really comes down to us educating on the language, educating on the nuances, educating on complications that may stem from too much of something or not enough of something else, but also the counseling effects of it too. So when it comes to the family dynamic, because I used to work down here at one of our community health centers, and you know, people would bring in their kids and be like, tell him to stop eating this. But I'm like, but you're also not enforcing things at home, and I don't live with you. And there's also that, you know, reward system too, that I grew up, right? We talked about, I grew up being held hostage at the table. And I also lived with a family who came from famine and came from war. They were, you know, they came over here from from Italy, and they were of the mindset of scarcity mindset and famine. And so, you know, we are not here to waste food. But as a 6 or a 7 year old, I didn't have the language to say, well, don't feed me like a 20 year old. I can't possibly eat this, you know, bucket of lima beans that you've put in front. I keep bringing up lima beans when I tell this story because it is 100% true. And I'm just sharing that because I like lima beans now.
I used to feed them to my dog under the table.
Right. But at the time I'm like, how old am I? Like, stop force feeding me liver and lima beans. I don't like that stuff. And I don't have the stomach capacity to take that in. But it really goes back to that family discussion. So as the healthcare provider, the behavioral therapist, anybody who is going to be an outside entity, and especially for me, I don't have children. So a lot of times I get the look of, well, what do you know? It's easy for you to say that. But I have to kind of train people to understand, you know, it does take time. It takes trial and error to get children to understand patterns. Also, even in the pickiest worlds, there's probably still 20 or 30 things that you can choose from and rotate and still provide enough, if you have the ability to do that, to, again, to provide energy and nutrition. So walk us through a little bit of maybe some of the conversations you've had to have outside of your own table of helping people who might be a little bit unwilling to, or maybe set in their ways of, this is how we do it. Like you said, the language that's used, how could you get somebody to see on from your side?
Yeah. And I think it's funny when you mentioned, like, they want you to fix it. Right. I think that happens a lot. Some of the funny stories we get, right. Like, the parents are like, yeah, like, they just won't eat it. And we're like, well, are you eating it? And they're like, no, I thought I just had to make these vegetables for my child. And we're like, no, like, the family needs to do this together. So I think part of it is just kind of building that rapport with them, and yes, stressing that, like, you can't just expect your child to make changes. Like, everybody really has to be on board, because if that kid, you know, whatever the condition is, I mean, it doesn't have to be an eating disorder. It could be somebody that's struggling with weight. It could be somebody, you know, a kiddo struggling with diabetes. If they're the only one that's being asked to make changes, like, that's not fair. They feel singled out, and it's never going to end up the way that they're expecting. So I think it's getting everyone on board and starting with small changes, right? Like you mentioned, like, it's not going to happen overnight. you know, finding those little things they can do. So I think it's really kind of assessing what their family patterns are like and getting to know them. Like, what do you usually cook? What is your family like? And then finding ways to just make some small changes that they're on board with, right? So when we go into that motivation, you know, you talk about motivational interviewing, and it really is like, we can tell them all day long what to do, but we know that that's not going to be successful. You know, maybe 1% of patients are going to take that and run with it, but it's really about getting to know them, what's important to them, what are they not going to change, right? Like, we need to know what our hard no's and where can we insert some small changes. So it might just be at the beginning, well, let's just add a fruit or a vegetable, right? Like, you know, maybe we're not even making big changes. It's just about every week, we're going to pick one new thing to try and we're going to cook it lots of different ways and we're going to start there. And so it's just really finding things to build on. And then maybe we're able to make changes to some of their recipes, right? With my Latino families, I think they're not going to change the foods they cook, but maybe we can just change a little bit the way they're cooking it, so it's a little bit more healthful. And then we're including some more nutrient dense foods to help round it out, right? So I think it's just really important to work with them. And then to know, you mentioned, you know, budgets, right? To know their budgets. We can't be recommending that they're buying organic chicken when they can't afford that. So it's really knowing, okay, I'm going to talk about frozen vegetables today. Like, we can't demonize frozen or canned foods. Like, there are lots of very nutritious options out there. And so it's kind of knowing your audience and making sure that they're part of the plan, because you can write out a list, but if they're not on board with it. And we also, I find myself also still planning too many things, but I have to like really focus on like, we're going to set like 2 or 3 goals max, because any more than that, it's not going
to
happen.
So this brings me to the discussion around cultural humility and meeting people where they're at. And why I was laughing too when you were saying that, because as I gave an example earlier, it's not just about here's a meal plan, follow the Mediterranean diet when you have nothing in your background that is Mediterranean based. And even watching our language about healthifying your current traditional meals, because we don't want to say that, or we don't want you as the patient and the family to think that anything you're doing is wrong, but there are maybe some modifications you can do to add different approaches to it to help you with some of those, you know, healthier approaches, I guess, in that sense, whether it's portions or the methods of cooking, deep frying versus sauteing, you know. And again, yes, that's going to be trial and error, because I know how much things, you know, are delicious and tasteful when you deep fry them. And we don't want you to end up being like, these white girls are giving us all this stuff to take home, and that is not how I want it to. Same thing goes for, you know, our replacement or substitutions of things. I'm very against, don't eat chocolate, instead have a celery stick. You know, like, you want chocolate, have the chocolate. Exactly. But let's talk about portion control, indulgences. You know, there's maybe a time and place for everything. Let's talk about patterns, and not that we have to sit there and critically analyze every choice you make, but it opens up a conversation that I feel does, it invites the whole village to come in on that. And there's no judgment there. So again, as kind of a PSA to anyone listening to this, if you are currently at a doctor's office, a healthcare provider's office, where they're not explaining things to you, they're not meeting you halfway, they're maybe being judgmental and making you feeling a little bit less than because of whatever choices you're making, whatever culture you belong to, whatever things you are non-negotiables, right? If I don't want to do something because it doesn't fit in my lifestyle, we have to find ways to work around that. So if you have the ability to do it, speak up. If you have the ability to do it, change providers or find other people who are better suited for you. Because also in our world of dietetics, we are finding that, you know, there are definitely people who are very stuck in their ways. It's very all or nothing approach, or a, you know, one size fits all approach. And then there's definitely people like Drew and myself who are listening and learning and repositioning ourselves and inviting conversations to better understand the communities with whom we work. And that's really what it's all about, my friends, is to help you help yourselves in whatever way you can do that. So Drew, as we're coming upon the end of our conversation here, I want to ask first, because we talked a little, I mean, eating disorders in itself could be a hot topic, and so can the language like clean eating. But is there anything that you're seeing in your world that could be misinformation, disinformation, anything that kind of gets your blood pressure going?
So many things. I mean, that's like a whole, probably a whole podcast in and of itself, things that drive us crazy. But I think it really just comes back to like any of those fad things, right? Like keto's been really hot lately, you know, keto 2.0, all of those types of things. I think just any of those buzzwords, I think will get under my skin, right? Because I just feel like it takes away from that focus on just balance. And I always go back to like, if we have to go on a diet, what does that mean? That typically means somebody is going to go off the diet, right? And so that's kind of how I would, you know, talk to my patients, like and for in general, right? I'm speaking just very generally, you know, there are some healthful diet patterns out there. So I'm not demonizing, you know, in general, but you know, my goal is that my patients and families leave with tips that are just lifestyle changes, right? And it seems so, you know, so cliche to go back to like, you know, diet and exercise, but it really comes down to like those general patterns and just making sure that, you know, patients are learning that these are changes that I want you to keep for a lifetime. Like you mentioned, like I'm the dietitian. I'm right at the beginning. I'm like, I am never going to tell you, you can't eat something. Never. Because I don't want somebody telling me I can't have chocolate or coffee or pizza. Like I would walk out. So, you know, it's not about what you can't eat. It is about like the portion sizes and how often are you having it? And so, I think those are the types of things that will really get under my skin is, you know, when people are it's that all or nothing telling you, you can't do something, or this is what you have to do to be healthy. No, all of these things can work. It's just about how often we're doing them, you know, about those healthy patterns. And so I think that's what I like my patients to leave with is knowing that, you know, I can still eat my potato chips every now and again. I can still do these things, but I'm also going to have, you know, maybe I'm going to think about how many fruits and vegetables I've had this week, or I'm going to think about like, I need to include some protein, when I'm eating my major meals, you know, things like that. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to mention just one thing that gets under my skin. I think just in general, like the fads, because they're always changing. But I hear the newest thing and it just makes me cringe because yeah. I'm like, oh, here we go again. We gotta like get our explanations ready to go.
That is a fantastic point. Because as you were speaking, I was writing down some key words of defining things, right? So if we hear a fad diet, it's like, oh God, what now? Like, what's this new thing I have to know about? But I appreciate people bringing me information, because then again, that opens up a discussion of how is it defined? What is it that they're telling you have to do or not do? What are the restrictions or the rules that you have to follow? And for how long? Is this a short-term thing? Is it a long-term thing? What is the end result? Because if it is a quick fix, my friends, hate to break it to you, just like Drew just said, if you're getting on something, you're going to be getting off something. So whatever results you had might be super successful. And then boom, if you can't maintain or sustain that approach, you're back in the saddle. And that also talks, going back to the mental health discussion too, you know, I think in so many of these episodes, we've talked about immediate gratification versus delayed gratification. Why do we always, as humans in this country, maybe this world, need those quick fixes and not really want to do the deep diving of what's at the heart of the choices that I make or the patterns that I can't seem to let go of? What is at the heart of that? And that's, you know, that's again for a whole other discussion of
the hard work,
learning.
It's hard. It's hard to dig deep and figure out what those things are. And I think, you know, I think the more technology we've had, you know, I hate to bring that in. That's again, a whole nother, you know, concept, but we like things at our fingertips. We like instant. And so it's just learning how to take a step back and realize like not all things in life are going to be instant gratification. Doing some of that hard work, right? Which might mean, you know, it doesn't mean going to therapy for everyone, but it could just mean doing some self-reflection and like, what is it? Like, why am I always going back to these patterns? Why am I finding it difficult to maintain this? Or just recognizing when you've gotten off track and be like, okay, man, we've been eating out a ton. So I recognize that these past couple of weeks have been a little bit crazy. We've been a little bit off our schedule, but now we're going to get back into, I'm going to make a plan. I'm going to grocery shop. I'm going to get back on our, you know, whatever plan, healthy, you know, eating. Again, I don't like using that word,
but understood.
A regular eating pattern, right? And focus on eating out less.
I always come back to the permission to give myself flexibility, the ability to course correct and set up boundaries with others or myself. So just like you gave an example, if I do see that I'm getting a little bit off of my usual pattern, and I do suffer from some GI issues, so I'm very mindful of my outside foods coming in. You know, you can't help everything. You don't know who's going to sneeze on whatever today, if that's the case, which has happened recently. And so if I see things like that happening, then I look back to what's going on, Dina? Like, where is your schedule? Are you not waking up as planned? Because I have for myself now at the tender age of almost 55, that I have a checklist of things for myself that I know keep me on track. And especially if I'm not getting a chance to meet with my therapist on a weekly basis, or there are times where I might not have any check-ins, or I might be medicated, or I might not be medicated. I'm very transparent with a lot of the things that I've used to help treat myself and my concerns and my both mental and physical issues. But I have the strategies and tools. Like, I have a toolkit now that I know I can go back to. It's become second nature for me. People starting out with these conditions, with these diagnoses, or learning how to navigate a new world, especially in the case of adolescents, or even in the people around them who are responsible, it's very time consuming. It takes time to ramp up, and it takes time to, again, try different things and say that didn't work as planned, or maybe we didn't do this enough to see what the patterns might become. So you might have some self-reflection. You might want to just jot down, journal something of, you know, I've noticed things that come up when I X, then Y, and getting other people's input too. Like, are you noticing some other, like, am I feeling, I don't know, I feel like I'm really curt lately. Am I coming across like that? I think I might need a day off. So, you know, just collecting data along the way, I know for me really helps. I get to see those patterns come up and where I can say, let me be a little bit more gentle for myself. Let me give myself grace. Let me have some flexibility, give myself permission to not be so on top of things. At the time of this recording, we're in, if anybody believes in this, we're in between winter solstice and the Lunar New Year. This is a time for hibernation, especially in the Northeast where we don't get a lot of sun and the days are shorter. Thankfully, time is getting a bit longer. So if you feel like you're kind of, you know, dialing it down a bit, it doesn't mean that you're lazy. It might mean that your body just needs a minute to gain a little bit more energy. Or you can compare that to, what am I normally like on days like this? And maybe I'm not getting enough vitamins in my diet, or I'm not, you know, getting enough sleep, which is another factor of concern when it comes to metabolism and eating and everything else that's health and wellness related. So Drew, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, absolutely. Yeah. That sleep is one of the things I talk to everyone about, and they're like, how does this relate to nutrition? I'm like, oh, it has everything to do with nutrition, let me tell you. But yes. And I think having a dietitian or a therapist or having those providers helps you to develop that toolbox, right? You mentioned kind of, we have those tools, but they've taken years and years to develop, right? So I think that's part of the beauty of working with somebody, is them being able to like give you that insight, right? And so that's what we're there for, right? As providers, is to help you gain that insight and to you know, help you be more flexible with yourself and to have that toolbox so that you can, you know, we're all going to get off track, and to help you get back on track so it doesn't become, you know, this sustained period of time that could affect you, you know, in lots of different ways.
Long term, right? This new fresh set of eyes that's coming in with a little bit of guidance. My question is always too, with us as healthcare providers, as I just kind of confessed out some things that I don't necessarily keep on track with, maybe fall off track, if we can use that as a term. What are things that you're doing? What's a current week in the life of you that you are navigating, both what you do in the business and professional world, but also how do you incorporate your own self-care for yourself and your family?
Yeah. So I think one thing that I've instituted and like the kids love is we, you know, either Saturday or Sunday, like we meal plan. And so they know, because if we don't meal plan, right, then we're not going to have a plan and we're planning to fail. So we kind of get together as a family, and it's quick. It's usually over coffee or breakfast in the morning, or we're sitting around, but everybody gets to chime in and pick what they want for dinner that week. And, you know, we make a plan and I make the grocery list and we go shopping. So that's one thing that just keeps us on track, as, you know, as far as like getting meals on the table, but lets the kids get to be involved. Or if I have new recipes to try, you know, they'll get to like pick which one they want to do. And so then they're excited about the week, and they like when I write it out. Like, we literally have a menu in the kitchen, and for some kids that are picky or, you know, things, it kind of gets them excited about what's to come, about trying new things. Because sometimes for families, that's, you know, might be scary or hard if you've got different things going on. So that's one thing we do. And, you know, it is a bit of self-care, right? Because we are, you know, making sure that we're eating well for the week. But then I really do try to make sure that my week has some time for, you know, me to get in some yoga or some strength training, you know, things like that. And I try to make sure that I'm putting that in because I know I feel better. It helps me maintain my, you know, release the stress and keep myself feeling good. But I'd say those are like probably the two big things that I try to get in every single week, you know, no matter what.
And as a business owner, as somebody who's running your practice there, are you also confined to time restraints? Are you working until 11 o'clock at night? Like, do you have start and end times where you say, okay, this is when I'm like working and when I'm stopping working? And of course, it could be also your family dynamic doesn't allow you maybe to work past a certain time. But how are you able to set boundaries with yourself in that way?
I'm probably not so great. One thing I do need to work on. I actually work from a home now. So it gets a little, it's the pros and cons, right? Like I am flexible. I can pick up my kids from school. I can go on those field trips. I can get them to practices. But that also does mean that sometimes I'm working, you know, nights and weekends to kind of make up for that time. And then doing, you know, blogging on the side, you know, so it is just trying to set those boundaries and making sure that I am making sure I get to bed on time, right? And getting my sleep in. And I do have an end time. So that does take some self-reflection sometimes to be like, okay, I've been working way too much. I have to set some limits. But in the end, I think it does balance itself out because I do get to attend a lot of their things. But it is the, if anyone works from home, you kind of know that challenge that you do kind of have to be mindful of how much you're, it can become very easy to like just continue to work all the time.
The struggle is real, especially I've said this before, our apartment is very, very small. So it's not like I have an office where I can go in and then leave. It's, you know, my office is my table outside, my chair, my bedroom, whatever happens, sometimes my bathroom while I'm checking emails in there and doing my makeup, whatever. There's no, like, everything's just a blurred line. So I love what you said too, just making sure we're mindful. And also the flexibility too. There might be sometimes where it's like, you know, there's tournaments or there's seasonal things or graduations are happening. And, you know, these are going to be not more like the exception to the rule. So Drew, let's wrap up our conversation with a couple of things. Number one, is there anything that we did not discuss that you might want to share? Words of wisdom, anything that I didn't ask?
Oh, you know, I think just at the end of the day, you know, the thing I like to let families know is, you know, I feel like everybody gets so worried that they're doing everything wrong or they've lost so much time. Like, oh my gosh, I didn't do any of these things. And it's like, you know what? We have to let go of that guilt and you can always make a change now. So whatever that change is, like, maybe you're going to start having family dinners and maybe it can't be every night because of schedules, but you're going to look at those schedules and figure out, you know what, we're going to eat dinner together as a family these days, or I'm going to start there. So just let go of the guilt. We have too much of that. And just what can I do now moving forward and forget that. So I think that'd probably be my one piece of advice. Cause I think we get so wrapped up in the coulds and shoulds and what we should have been doing. And it's, you know, we've lost so much time, but there's always tomorrow, right?
And that is a fantastic philosophy of live and learn, let go, move forward, you know, try. Exactly. I love that. And then my final question to you, which is my two-part pun, my food pun question, is what is on your plate today, Drew? After we wrap up and you disconnect from me, what is the next thing that you're doing or working on? And then what is the next meal that you'll be having?
Oh, so while we plan our meals, we'll go with that one first, right? And I will say my kids, they get so excited. They're like little foodies. I love it. But they love this pesto pasta with Brussels, like shaved Brussels. It's like their favorite dish ever. So that's what we're having because we meal, you know, we planned that already. It's a family favorite. And then in terms of like work, you know, I have started this blog and it's just a baby blog and, you know, but it is really to kind of get out some of that, like, you know, the passion project, right? Like putting some recipes out there, like quick and easy. Like for me, I feel like being a busy mom, I work full time. You know, my kids are super active, you know, we do PTA stuff. We do all of those things, right? How do we still get those healthy, saying it again, how do we still get those meals on the table? How do we make that happen on weekdays, right? Well, how can we still prepare some fresh and quick and easy things when we're also busy and on the go, or when we have food allergies in the house, or when we have selected eaters, like how do we not make 10 meals for every single person? So just really kind of focusing on those fun things and bringing in just some tips and tricks in like a real life way. So that's kind of what I've been working on the, you know, kind of on the side for fun.
Well, it's going to be a fantastic resource, and I always link to everything that my guests share so that people who are listening to this know how to find you and be able to get some of your guidance. Because like you said, you're coming from a place that is very understandable, and you're connecting with a group of people out there that you know what you're talking about. So I very much appreciate that. And I want to chime in here, because as you were talking to, I can't remember, and I'm sorry for whoever I'm not crediting properly, but the word balance, right? Work-life balance or home-life balance or whatever, instead of that word balance now, I've started using a new term, harmony. So, because I think sometimes people think it has to be a 50-50 split, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's 80-20 or 20-80 in the opposite direction. Or, you know, when seasonal things happen, it's never a linear straight line anywhere ever. So it's just about making sure that we touch upon whatever factors are important to us, that we prioritize that, and we don't let too many things slide, so that we do live in the state of harmony, that we feel everything's being touched. And at the end of the day, we can say, I'm very grateful that I was able to play a role in this life and support myself in the way that I needed to. So Drew, thank you so much for the time that we spent here, for everything that you shared with me. I'm very much looking forward to hearing any feedback that people have about this episode. And I hope that we get to cross paths one day, either in real life or on the virtual space soon.
Thank you so much, Dina. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's been great.
Thank you so much for joining me this week on the Dish with Dina podcast. I am Dina D'Alessandro, registered dietitian, nutritionist, founder, and chief executive life changer at Dish with Dina, and I'm also your host. If you like what you heard, I would be so grateful if you could subscribe to this podcast, leave a review, and share this with others who you think might benefit from what we have to offer on these episodes. You can also join my mailing list at dishwithdina.com or email me at info@dishwithdina.com with questions, comments, feedback, and if you'd like to be a guest on a future episode, because everybody eats and we all have a story to share. I hope you tune back in next week when we dish again.